loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, Democrat Connor Lamb came out of yesterday's special election in Pennsylvania with a razor-thin lead over Republican Rick Saccone, 49.8% to 49.6%, a difference of only 641 votes. Election officials are now counting absentee and provisional ballots, but most news networks already have called the race for Lamb. We'll look at what this means for both parties as we approach the midterm elections in 2018. In our second segment, we talk about, again, nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, the nuclear industry, nuclear danger, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. This is our regular Wednesday segment with experts Kevin Camps and Greg Mello.
But before we get to Pennsylvania's special election, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, British Prime Minister Theresa May announced this morning that she will expel 23 Russian diplomats in response to the poisoning of a Russian double agent in the UK. May declined to offer any evidence of Russian involvement in the poisoning during question time in Parliament, and Scotland Yard has said only that a nerve agent was used. Next, President Donald Trump was in California yesterday to personally inspect prototype sections of what would be a new border wall. He also took the opportunity to insult Governor Jerry Brown and the people of California for not supporting him in his immigration crackdown. Then, Defense Secretary James Mattis arrived in Afghanistan yesterday to meet with senior U.S. and Afghan officials and to discuss the possibility of peace talks with elements of the Taliban. Mattis told the press that the Taliban leadership has developed cracks in its unity in recent years and that now is the time to begin talking about the terms of peace. And then Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte said today that his country will immediately withdraw its ratification of the International Criminal Court's establishing treaty. This move comes amid a wave of repressive state violence targeting journalists, activists, and the poor. And finally, congressional legislation is being considered this week based on so-called right-to-try laws in several states. These laws allow terminally ill patients to immediately access any experimental treatments that aren't already approved by the FDA. However, over 99% of applications to the FDA are approved, usually within days of the application, and this dangerous idea could lead to human experimentation in addition to other harmful ills. And in other headlines, according to multiple reports, Larry Kudlow will be named to lead the National Economic Council following the departure of Gary Cohn. A former official with the Reagan administration who has since become a TV personality, Kudlow is considered to hold orthodox Republican views on economic issues, including opposition to protectionist trade measures like tariffs. Despite their policy differences, Trump and Kudlow are considered to be personally close to one another. Students left classrooms today in a nationwide walkout to protest gun violence and demand change. Officially lasting for 17 minutes, 1 minute for each student death at Parkland High School, the hashtag Enough National School Walkout started at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time and moved west across the country, with student protesters participating in all parts of the U.S. This comes at a time of increased student activism after the Parkland mass shooting. Nearly 6 months after the general election, Angela Merkel has been voted in by the German parliament for another term as chancellor. Merkel's Christian Democratic Union had been locked in a protracted, difficult coalition negotiation before finally reaching an agreement with the Social Democratic Party. If Merkel stays in office for a full term, she will tie the record of her mentor, Helmut Kohl, as the longest-serving German chancellor. Stephen Hawking died today at 76. He was an internationally renowned scientist who expanded our understanding of space, quantum theory, and our own existence. He wrote the best-selling book, A Brief History of Time. He supported the rights of Palestinians and helped the boycott, divest, and sanction movement gain mainstream awareness, and he also opposed the Iraq War, at one point reading the names of all those killed at an anti-war demonstration. Those are today's headlines. Next up is Pennsylvania's special election. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
John Kiriakou, in this half hour, we're going to talk about that special congressional election that took place yesterday in Pennsylvania. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author. He's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM Channel 126. And we're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and the author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Welcome to all of you.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
John, before we get started, there's some breaking news about this election.
Yeah, we do have some breaking news. This is coming from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette saying GOP gearing up to challenge District 18 results and impound all voting machines used in special election. And what they're saying specifically is, I'm quoting from the article, "It is not yet clear where such a petition would be filed, but Republicans are investigating a number of purported election day irregularities, including problems with the machines, voters being told to go to the wrong polling places, and Republican attorneys being barred from overseeing the counting of absentee ballots in Allegheny County." County spokeswoman Annie Downs said that on election day, there had been discussions with Republican attorneys about their ability to oversee the vote counting process. Under the state election code, such observers must have a signed authorization from the chair of the county committee, and they didn't produce such an authorization until the very end of the evening after the ballots had already been counted. It goes on to say at the end that these irregularities really aren't irregularities. What it says is that there were numerous reports of voters being confused about whether they lived in the 18th district or another district because of the saturation bombing TV campaign, or confusion stemming from a court battle over whether district lines would be redrawn now or redrawn later in the year. The county reported only a couple of isolated problems with voting machines. Really, it was just low battery power in one of them.
All right. Anyway, the Republicans are on the march here. Of course, this was a really, really close election, hundreds of thousands of votes. But the difference between Connor Lamb, the Democrat, and the Republican, Rick Saccone, down to just several hundred votes. And let's start with Dave Lindorf, even though he's in another part of Pennsylvania. You're in Pennsylvania, so we'll give you the first stab at this. First of all, Dave, one of the things that's most noteworthy, this was a special election, in many ways a symbolic election, because this district is about to go out of existence as a result of redistricting. And yet, I think as much as $15 million, most of it Republican, about 3-to-1 spending difference there, poured into this symbolic, essentially symbolic race. Anyway, Dave Lindorf, go ahead. What's your take?
Well, first of all, the district's going to disappear, but it's going to be merged into, you know, several different districts. And so the election was important for whoever won it, because they'll have like a real leg up in whatever district Lamb or I forget the other guy's name.
Saccone
would be running in November. So, you know, because they'll be a member of Congress for half a year or more. But, I mean, the big deal here is not so much whether one person won or another, but how vastly different the vote went than it went for Trump in the last election, because, you know, he won I think a 20% margin over Hillary Clinton in the district, and now you've got a race where, you know, it's a hair's breadth difference. But in terms of the seating, there is some importance, even though the district's disappearing.
Yeah, Wilmer Leon is another guest. We're talking to Dr. Leon from Washington, D.C. Of course, the Democrats are reading this, Dr. Leon, as a precursor to the 2018 election. If Donald Trump won this district by 20% in 2016, and they lost or narrowly won, even if it turned out that this was remarkably reversed in Rick Saccone's favor, that this would be a sign, a referendum, really, of Donald Trump, and a good sign for the Democrats, a blue wave coming. Maybe the Democrats would retake the House. We'll talk about what the possible significance of that might be should it happen. Same with the Senate. Anyway, what's your read?
Well, I think that the Democrats can definitely look at the outcome in Pennsylvania as a very good sign for what may be coming in 2018. Donald Trump won this district, I believe, by 20 points. And now you have Saccone probably losing in a very tight race, but a loss is a loss. And they really, I don't think the Republicans can blame this on Saccone running a bad campaign. And they are also saying that Lamb ran as a Republican because Saccone is the Republican. And he ran as the Republican. And Trump went in and supported him twice. So I think there's nothing but an indication that the tide is turning as we look towards November 6, 2018.
Okay. And then, Daniel Lazar, let's ask you, Donald Trump was there. He made one of his, he's on the campaign trail again, both for 2018 and 2020. He was there in Pennsylvania. He gave this rip-roaring classic Donald Trump speech. A lot of commentators are suggesting that that had a negative impact, in fact, in some ways inside this election. What's your read on it?
Well, they're probably right. It did probably have a negative impact. I mean, look, Trump is an increasingly unpopular guy, and this election certainly shows it. But I think it's very important to keep in mind for the kind of campaign that that Lamb ran. I mean, he ran the blandest, most centrist, most Republican-light campaign you can possibly imagine. He used the D word, Democrat, as infrequently as possible. He avoided taking strong stances on anything, and so he really was the un-Trump candidate. So therefore, what this means is that Trump's is extremely unpopular. Things look extremely bad for the Republicans in November, but it still means that the political system as a whole is not moving leftward. If anything, it's staying standing pat or even still moving further to the right.
That's an important point, John. I mean, if you're having Democrats who are basically mirroring the Republican talking points in large measure, and that was true in this campaign. The Democrat was all about tariffs, for instance.
It, true in the Alabama Senate campaign as well.
Yeah, and then after Doug Jones won, surprisingly, against a very weak candidate, Roy Moore in Alabama, and he won because of the grassroots support, particularly from African-American women in Alabama. In other words, the most progressive sector of the electorate in Alabama. Jones moved instantly to the right and is, basically cavorting with Donald Trump. So there's two issues here. There's the issue of, do the Democrats actually win the House? And then secondly, does it actually matter?
Well, I would challenge you on that on one point, which is that Lamb ran an issueless campaign, basically, because he was trying to win votes from the left, which he did. And which he got, and he also was trying to win votes from the center, the sort of conservative Democrat, blue-collar types, which he also won. But I think that the one thing that stood out about his positions, which he did articulate pretty clearly, was that he was very strongly pro-labor, pro-organized labor, pro-working person's issues. And that is not Republican in any way, shape, or form.
That's not quite true.
Go ahead, Dr. Leon, go ahead.
As we try to parse this out, what I think we take away from this is that the Democrats finally understand you have to run candidates in districts that articulate issues that will win in the districts they're running in. So would Lamb win with this campaign in California? Probably not. But funny thing, it wasn't California, it was Pennsylvania. So you run candidates and you articulate issues that will resonate within the constituency whose votes you are trying to get. And I think they are finally understanding that that's the political reality. And if they had understood that when Hillary Clinton was running, Donald Trump might not be your president.
Daniel Lazar, this is that age-old Democratic conundrum. Are they the big tent party that welcomes blue dog Democrats down south and Laborcrats who are pro-life and pro-gun in the Northeast, or are they more ideologically pure, and do they shun those kinds of Democrats and just try to win as progressives?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it sounded to me like, Dr. Leon, that you were saying exactly what I was saying. I was pointing to that stance he took on working people, because that was the issue that was going to win in that district. I think the interesting thing is the Democrats are kind of, you know, you have to understand that the two-party system here has become, because of the way it works, you can only have two parties the way our congressional system and our politics has evolved. It's a winner take all, and if you run as a socialist, as the socialists did in the 30s, winning millions of votes, you're still powerless because you can't get on any committees. You can't, you know, you're just marginalized. It's not like a parliamentary system where you get coalitions and stuff. And so the Democrats and the Republicans have evolved into these sort of bland, big tent kind of parties by necessity. So if people on the left like myself really rebel against supporting this. But if you look at it from the point of view of Democrats getting power, they're only going to do it if they do like Dr. Leon said, and, you know, run people who will win in the districts they're running in.
Let's give Daniel a shot in here. Go ahead, Daniel.
I mean, they're saying is the Democrats, you know, stand for nothing. They're incoherent. They'll say whatever people want them to say, and their victory adds up to nothing. I mean, Lamb actually ran a campaign ad showing him, you know, proudly firing an AR-15. He had lots of union backing, but he refused to back a $15 minimum wage. I mean, the guy is as conservative as you can get, you know, short of being an outright Trumper. So the Democrats may eke out a victory, but, you know, but what does it mean?
Okay, Dr. Leon, go ahead.
it means he won, and B, it means, again, he ran as a moderate Republican, but the Republican lost. As the Republican lost in Alabama, as the Republican lost in Virginia, and to say that the campaign was void of substance, that really doesn't carry any provable empirical support. That's just rhetoric.
Let's keep this discussion going. I'm going to jump in a moment, but who is next in line here? I think that's Dave Lindorf.
Yeah. No, I think we're all sort of agreeing here in coming at it from different angles that America's not going to change dramatically going from one party to another because of the fact that the parties can't really stand for anything, substantially different from the establishment situation we have now. You do, on the margins, have significant differences, though. I mean, if the Democrats win Congress, then you don't get crazy legislation passed by Trump because it won't pass the House. And you're not going to see foreign policy change. You're not going to see, like, major changes in the size of the defense budget, maybe even sometimes more under Democrats. You're not going to see probably even, I don't know, maybe you'll get some gun legislation if the Democrats take over the House, but it won't be as dramatic as people might wish who are pushing for, you know, real crackdown on automatic weapons and everything. It's because the Democrats will be afraid of losing their gun vote, which they do get some of. So it's just all this is on the margins, but it does make some differences. But I'm just trying to say You're not going to get a sweeping, suddenly like pro-worker party coming in the Democrats, even if they do manage to elect a few more progressives.
And in fact, when the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette endorsed Saccone a couple of days ago, they didn't do it because Saccone was some terrific candidate. They didn't even do it because of what Saccone stood for as a candidate. What they specifically said in this editorial was that voters had to choose Saccone because if they chose Lamb, it would give one more vote to the Democrats, and all the Democrats want to do is impeach the president. So if you don't want to impeach the president, you have to vote for Saccone. It had nothing to do with the issues of this district. And with that said, I want to turn to Wilmer Leon as soon as I finish this thought. Brian, as you noted in the introduction, this district is going to go away in a matter of months. And the Cook Political Report is saying that Lamb is all but certain to run in the new 17th district. It says it's a seat that's almost tailor-made for him. It includes the southern half of suburban Allegheny County, which is where Pittsburgh is. And it's 8 percentage points less Republican than the district that he won in yesterday. And then Saccone is already telling people he's going to run in the new 14th district, which is the next district farther south from what will be Lamb's new district. And it's 3 percentage points more Republican than the district that he lost in yesterday. So this is all just musical chairs for our own entertainment.
And Dr. Leon, you jump in a moment, but let's remember that was $15 million spent.
Exactly.
On what appears to be a purely symbolic election. I mean, I know $15 million isn't a big deal to politics in America, given the fact that $5 billion was spent in the presidential election. But a lot of money, it's a lot of money for people who don't have money. It's a lot of people money for people, say, who don't have homes. But Dr. Leon, jump in. We have about 4 minutes left.
Well, I think the Republicans backing Saccone is a great investment if he wins. He loses. Therefore, the dynamics of the whole conversation change. And so even though he's going to run again, I don't know that the Republican Party is going to be nearly as enthusiastic about putting the money behind him as they would have been had he won this election. Because now when you listen to the post-election critique from Republicans, they say that the guy is a lousy candidate. They say that the guy really had no business being in the race. So, and I'm not saying whether that's true or not. What I'm saying is, that's the analysis that's coming from the Republicans. This, I think, even though it was only for an 8-month seat, it was a very, very symbolic election, which did not turn out in the favor of the Republicans.
Daniel Lazar, our colleague here at Sputnik, Eugene Puryear, was speculating in the last hour that opioids may have something to do with the way this race fell, that Lamb was talking about opioids being a problem in places like, not just like, you know, the city of Pittsburgh, but this is a generally rural, very, very white rural district, and that Saccone never addressed the issue of opioids. Do you think that may have been something important?
I'm sorry, I can't help you on that in that regard, because I mean, Lamb said as little as possible to that would get himself into trouble. So if he was going to take a controversial stance on opioids, I don't think he would have done it.
Maybe the people on the opioids were the ones that were having difficulty finding their voting district.
Well, I mean, all joking aside, I mean, we have this big drug epidemic, and I think the point that we're making here is that perhaps the administration is being held partly responsible for inaction. The Trump administration has done most of its work on so-called health care by trying to repeal even those parts of or sabotage or destroy those parts of the Affordable Care Act, as defective as it is. But those parts that expanded Medicaid coverage and allowed people to try to get medical coverage, those especially who are suffering from the opioid crisis and previously had no access to health care.
That's certainly true. And in fact, that is one area in which Lamb did hit Saccone hard on. Medicare and Obamacare. So that may be true to that extent. And Trump clearly is in trouble with regard to those policies as well.
Yeah, Lamb was making the point that as a prosecutor, he had gone after, you know, those who were really promoting and pushing and helping to create the opioid crisis and to send some of them to jail. And also linking the medical crisis, the problem of opioid addiction, the epidemic of it, to the economic crisis, to the hollowing out of America's industrial heartland. Dave Lindorf, where does this go in terms of the next steps? Obviously, we know, as John Kiriakou said at the beginning of this program, the Republicans are, John, they're impounding the voting machines.
The voting machines. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is reporting now further that even if there were irregularities, the number of complaints that have been made by the Saccone campaign and by the Pennsylvania State Republican Party's attorneys would not account for enough votes to swing this race, that the race really is Lamb's. And, you know, it makes you wonder, too, if the Republicans' $15 million wouldn't have been better spent in another race or another series of races that actually count rather than in a district that's going to go away in a few months.
Okay, go ahead, Dave. We have 90 seconds left.
Yeah, this has become sort of like a tradition in American elections now. Whenever there's a close election, you cry fraud and you call for recounts and you impound the voting machines. But, you know, it usually doesn't result in any change. Things aren't as quite as chaotic as they appear with the voting machines and stuff. But I did want to say with the Medicaid thing, I think that's a huge reason that this went the way it did. And I think it's a real problem for Trump going forward, because I've got a place in the summer up where we live up in the Catskills where it's real Appalachia, and people voted heavily for Trump, but now they're losing their Medicaid, and they're really, really upset.
Those are really important points, and that could be very impactful, especially on these swing state areas. We're out of time. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author. He's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM Channel 126. And we're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we're joined from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our regular Wednesday segment where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. And we're joined from the Washington, D.C. area by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Kevin and Greg, welcome back.
Thank you.
I want to get both of you to make a brief comment, your own assessment, if you would, about the appointment following the firing of Rex Tillerson, the appointment of Mike Pompeo to be the new Secretary of State. Of course, he has to be confirmed, as does the new CIA director. But we have this coming on the eve of what would be Donald Trump's decision to announce that Iran is either in compliance or not in compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Arms Deal. What does this have significance, the replacement of Tillerson with Pompeo? Let's start with you, Greg.
I'm not completely sure, but I'm afraid it probably does. The neoconservatives seem to be tightening their grip on the government. And they Trump doesn't like things associated with Obama, and he doesn't like the Iran deal, and he's got a man who is more in line with his thinking on that, and that's not good.
Yeah. Kevin Camps, your impressions.
I agree, and I fear what it means for the North Korea situation. I mean, Trump just surprisingly agreed, supposedly, to a meeting with Kim Jong-un. So North Korea is supposed to believe in the good faith of the United States as it's ripping up a nuclear agreement with Iran. It's hard to wrap your head around.
Interestingly, ironically, maybe bizarrely, I was debating somebody on a television show yesterday somebody from the Trump camp who said that if Trump can get the deal done with North Korea, that will be a model for a future replacement deal with Iran. I thought, like, oh my God, this is really Alice in Wonderland. I mean, why on earth would North Korea or any government agree to some sort of nuclear disarmament package when it's clear that either Trump or the next president, given this kind of precedent, would just rip it up or could rip it up?
And the precedent of Libya ought to be a deal breaker for any other country being told by the United States to give up its weapons.
Absolutely. Give up your weapons of mass destruction and we'll go in and invade and bomb and destroy you and kill you.
Exactly.
Anyway, let's go on with some of our stories. Both Greg Mello and Kevin Camps, who are organizing and helping us lead this weekly segment on all issues nuclear. Real quick, let's go through some of the big stories for this week. Kevin Camp, 7 years on, sailors exposed to Fukushima radiation seek their day in court. What's that all about?
Yeah, there's a couple great articles just out, one by Greg Levine in The Nation magazine, another by my coworker Linda Gunter at Beyond Nuclear, about the sailors on the USS Reagan, several thousand sailors and sister ships, too, who responded immediately to the Japanese earthquake and tsunami in March of 2011, and then were in the middle of this nuclear catastrophe. And unfortunately, they were just offshore and downwind of these large-scale releases of hazardous radioactivity. And sure enough, hundreds and hundreds of these sailors are sick, severely ill with various maladies. And remember, these are people who are at peak health. They are in their teens or 20-somethings for the most part, very well fit, and they are very sick now 7 years later. Some have died from their maladies. And so they have a class action lawsuit. They're going after Tokyo Electric Power Company. They're going after General Electric. And it's been 7 years, and they're still fighting over legal standing and which court system, the U.S. or Japan, is this going to take place in. And a lot of them are just trying to, you know, get some money to help with their medical bills.
Greg, it's an important story, and it's a small part of a bigger story where people, whether they're people in the armed forces, people who are civilians and living close to nuclear facilities, people who are sometimes used as guinea pigs, there's a lot of victims of nuclear energy. And these corporations, and especially because of their connection to the U.S. or the Japanese government, they're protected, they're shielded. Other people get sick, other people die. They get protected. Go ahead.
They're shielded by propaganda first and foremost, and by the deep myths that we have of technological invulnerability, that we are basically in denial about the magnitude of the danger from radiation, which is for the most part invisible, although I don't think it was entirely invisible on the ships. And I mean, we're in a kingdom of illusion in a way, and it relates to your first story because your Trump friend, supporting friend, who thought we could just negotiate a new deal with Iran, and this is kind of the fantasy land, and sometimes you feel like we're in a cartoon republic or something, that we can just make things happen magically.
It's so true. It's as though things can happen magically. But one of the questions that I have is, why aren't Americans all over these issues? I mean, there's such a clear and present danger to all of us from these specific issues. Why is this not in the news? Why aren't people in the streets over it?
People's lives are precarious. They're economically less stable than they used to be. They're more socially isolated. They're not getting the supporting feedback from authority figures like news editors and society. Politicians stay away from difficult truths. These are some of the reasons that we see out where we are.
Yeah, and I just push back a little bit that, you know, you name the atomic reactor in the United States, and I'll name the watchdog group or other nuclear facilities like Los Alamos in New Mexico. There are people who have devoted their lives to watchdogging these facilities and getting the truth out. But like Greg just said, I mean, when you have major corporations involved in nuclear power, like Westinghouse, like General Electric, who own major media like ABC, like NBC, even Disney and ABC. I mean, Disney wrote Our Friend the Atom back in the 1950s. That media silence around these issues and giving a huge microphone to industry propagandists, and then the nuclear industry with its bottomless coffers hires the best public relation firms money can buy, and buys the best lobbyist money can buy. And that's what we're up against is, you know, essentially we're up against a multi-trillion dollar industry if you add it all up. And that's what it looks like.
Let's talk about how the government, you have another story here, Kevin, the latest bailout justification attempt at the Davis, Bessie, and Perry atomic reactors in Ohio. What's going on?
Well, several members of Congress in Ohio, including supposedly liberal Democrats like Marcy Kaptur and Fudge, who's a part of the Congressional Black Caucus, and some Republicans, have made the argument that these dangerously old reactors like Davis-Bessie on the Lake Erie shore in northern Ohio, over 40 years into its operations, deserve to be bailed out at public expense because we need that expertise in this country to maintain our nuclear weapons deterrent capabilities. So they are parroting something that Ernest Moniz, who was Obama's energy secretary, said several months back. It's a pretty desperate argument, especially speaking of propaganda. They've been trying to keep this illusion alive since the 1950s that there's some kind of separation between atoms for peace and atoms for war, when it's pretty darn clear that there's a lot of overlap between the two. Well, here they are pointing to that overlap and saying, hey, you have to bail out these atoms for peace that are dangerously age-degraded, could have breakdown accidents, because we need to maintain our nuclear weapons deterrent. And it's a farcical argument, but it's how desperate they are.
And it works. I mean, it works at least in some small part, maybe sufficiently. And it seems like, Greg Mello, that national security is just the canard. I mean, if you invoke national security, whether it's to impose 25% tariffs on steel or 10% tariffs on aluminum or to bail out failing nuclear power plants that have made their investors lots of money, but in fact are really dangerous and maybe not completely unnecessary. As long as you dress it up as national security, then, you know, everybody genuflex.
Well, they seem to anyway. The media does, and the politicians do, or afraid to say anything counter. What Moniz is concerned about is really an ultimate death scenario for the industry, which is the collapse of university programs in nuclear energy. They are very frightened in the nuclear weapons industry that they will not be able to recruit new generations of people to do what previous generations did. It's a very real fear. It has a real basis. One anthropologist spoke of the heroic mode of production where hundreds of thousands of workers, or 118,000, I think, that have been awarded money for their occupational injuries or deaths or survivors. And it's not clear that people are going to do that anymore. So we do have a very positive development from our perspective that people are wary of going into the nuclear weapons industry, but it spills over and it makes people like Ernie Moniz say, well, we have to indoctrinate people into the wonders of the atom, and they see it as a united whole.
Yeah, we talk about the military-industrial complex, but perhaps it is a military-industrial-academic complex. How does it work?
Ernie Moniz is a good case in point. He's an MIT nuclear engineering professor who got tapped by the Obama administration to be energy secretary and awarded $8.3 billion in federal taxpayer-backed nuclear loan guarantees to build two new reactors in Georgia. And just a few weeks ago, went to work for the company, Southern Nuclear, as one of its board of directors members. So just a scandalous revolving door that reeks to high heaven.
Well, just a little bit of a little anecdote. One of our interns who was studying nuclear engineering for its public policy aspects went to her department chair and said, well, I'm interning with the Los Alamos Study Group. And her department chair said, well, you've ruined your career. You'll never be hired by the labs now. And so it is very much ideological. So the failure of the academy to push back against crazy stuff, I guess, opens the field of leadership to those devoted amateurs that are outside those interest-conflicted environments, the type of people that Kevin was talking about. And I think that the field of leadership is quite open now. And I'm not sure that the public understands how effective and how joyful it can be to really make, you can really make a difference now when there's so many voices that should be speaking up that are silent.
Okay, let's explore that, because if there are people hearing this show in the Washington, D.C. area, including many, many universities and many young people who are thinking about what comes next after college or what comes next for high school students who are interested in issues like this, let's talk about what it means to make a difference.
Well, look at the difference that the Parkland survivors are making. You know, they're having a national rally in D.C. on March 24th to call for gun control measures. And you could apply that kind of energy and mass movement to, you know, anti-nuclear weapons, and we'd better take that seriously. I mean, fortunately, the Nobel Peace Prize last December went to the International Coalition to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, a very appropriate award at a very critical time, and we'd better address this issue or we may be sorry.
Oh, well, some of the details that Kevin has been providing in this conversation are examples of things which are powerful truths. The conflicts of interest of Ernest Moniz, for example, that's something which can be put into newspapers by ordinary people writing op-eds, letters to the editor. There are people that need to be publicly shamed, politicians at back home when they meet their constituents. We have a senator who's very evasive, a Democrat, Tom Udall. He does not want to talk about his support for building a factory for atomic bombs in his district because it's not popular. He wants the money from the contractors, but he doesn't want to talk about it. So, you know, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. And I think that maybe if there was a message that I'd like to get out to people about that, it's just dig in. And it's not instant gratification in every case, but the solidarity and friendships and social connections that one makes, you know, it's a bit of an adventure.
Let's use both of you as case examples, if we could. I mean, obviously, you're very respected, very knowledgeable in your fields. Kevin has a particular focus on nuclear energy and the nuclear energy industry, although he has great knowledge about nuclear weapons as well. Greg Mello, you at the Los Alamos Study Group are more focused on nuclear weapons but have great expertise and knowledge on the nuclear energy industry. Talk about how you ended up where you are, Kevin and Greg. I mean, how did you get to be where you are, to be leaders of the opposition, the real opposition to the madness that's the nuclear industry or the madness that is the nuclear weapons regime in America?
Well, funny enough, I started on nuclear weapons issues when I was in junior high. I think first day of seventh grade science class, my teacher put an op-ed. There's that op-ed that Greg was talking about. I've since figured out that it was probably a Physicians for Social Responsibility op-ed campaign. It described what would happen to my hometown, Kalamazoo, Michigan, if a Soviet 20 megaton nuclear warhead were to explode over downtown, these concentric circles of vaporization, essentially. And it led to years of anti-nuclear weapons activism. And then I learned about the nuclear power plant just 35 miles upwind of my home and made the switch over. But, you know, there it gets back to that flip sides of the same coin. There is so much overlap between these two industries. They are really one industry.
It's so true.
Go ahead, Greg.
Yes. In my case, most anti-nuclear activists have some similar roots. Of course, I grew up near a SAC base. The bombers flew over every day on their way to their fail-safe points.
Let's unpack some of that language. SAC base and also fail-safe. Strategic Air Command?
So H-bombs were, B-52s with H-bombs took off from near our house, and they flew over the house. We weren't real close, but you could see them every day on a kind of a clockwork schedule, and they would fly out over the Aleutians and circle around there waiting for an order to go annihilate Russia. And then they fly back. And then another set of bombers would go take their place along the way. They cross. So that was the pattern during the Cold War. And if there was anything that made the parental generation scared, which any kid could see, it was nuclear war. And it was really clear that no one had a handle on this. So that was ingrained pretty deeply. Living near Los Alamos, and I was a regulator, state regulator, first one at Los Alamos Lab, actually, and to see how pathetically run this place was compared to all the other industries that I visited, and how they lied, and, you know, just as a matter of course. And if they had a problem, they went straight to a political figure to fix the problem rather than actually doing something right. So, you know, that when the Cold War came in, when the end of the Cold War came, some of us who had been active in the peace community said, well, maybe we should push on this boulder and see, now that it's undercut somewhat, maybe we can get it to roll a different way. And we found it was much, it was really a lot easier than we had ever imagined.
Very interesting, John. I mean, you know, the point that we're making here, the point that Kevin is making, the point that Greg is making, is that if you have a problem, and the nuclear industry is a big problem, we have nuclear reactors that can wipe out, as we talked last time, almost lost Detroit, almost lost Harrisburg with Three Mile Island.
That's
you can
right.
go down the list, and Kevin and Greg can identify all the places that were near misses. Then there were places that weren't misses, like in Fukushima. And so we're sitting really on a time bomb or a bomb that's set to go off at some point because accidents happen. And as this industry and as its structures and facilities degrade, the likelihood of accidents become greater. The implications are profound. The number of casualties are almost unimaginable. That's just in the area of nuclear power. And then in the question of nuclear weapons, which is talked about in a cavalier way. You know, and it's kind of left to policy wonks, and or in the media you talk about, you know, what did Russia do? What did Putin say at his end of the year address? What new doomsday weapon did he demonstrate? Or a nuclear posture review, which people's eyes kind of glaze over. But we're talking about the possibility of a nuclear war or a nuclear exchange by mistake even. Again, that has catastrophic, profound impacts. And you can see by the arrangement of political and media forces that none of this will change
yeah.
unless people change. And people change, and when people change and decide to become actors in some political process, then real change is possible. But it won't be possible without it. That's why what Kevin Camps is doing at Beyond Nuclear or Greg Mello at Los Alamos Study Group for a long time, and both of you can testify to this, at times you must feel like you're alone, or it's you against the Himalayas that you have to now march up, and it seems almost impossible. And then yet things shift and they break suddenly and movements emerge and movements for change happen seemingly out of nowhere. But in fact, their time has come. And it seems to me, and I want to ask both of you this, given the dangers posed by, let's say, talk about the nuclear posture review, where now the U.S. is in the national security doctrine, where the U.S. is identifying the main threats, not Al-Qaeda, not ISIS, but major power confrontations with Russia and China, two other powers that have major nuclear arsenals. It seems crazy, and yet the people at the top are actually preparing for war.
And let me add something to that, too, Brian. There are countries that are backsliding on this issue, like Saudi Arabia, for example. Here you have a country that is swimming in oil, and it wants to be a nuclear power, at least a nuclear energy power. And so it's taking bids right now for the construction of a nuclear energy plant. Well, I, for one, don't trust the Saudis, or the Saudi government at least, to not try to enrich uranium that is eventually of weapons grade. Certainly, the Saudis are petrified of Iran and have made no bones about it. And I wouldn't be surprised if this were some kind of a cover to further develop and then spread nuclear weapons.
Okay, let's talk about the Saudis, Kevin Camps. They're enlisting Washington lobbyists in bids for nuclear power plants right now. Go ahead.
Well, Greg mentioned naming names earlier, and one name to mention is Jeffrey Merrifield, who is a lawyer in your neighborhood of the studio there. He works at Pillsbury, and he is a top lobbyist. He runs the energy program at Pillsbury, which is a pro-nuclear energy law firm. And he's up on Capitol Hill, part of this at least $450,000 per month that the Saudi government is spending to lobby the U.S. Congress to get permission to build perhaps American nuclear power plants. And it's an open secret that, you know, once Saudi Arabia has uranium enrichment and or plutonium reprocessing, that is their hedge against Iran getting it too, which are pathways to nuclear weaponry. I mean, don't take it from me. Take it from Mohammed El-Baradei, the Egyptian director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who won a Nobel Peace Prize, who said the reason that a dozen Arab countries want nuclear power is to have the pathway to nuclear weapons if they choose to use it that way.
That's really important. Greg, jump in if you would.
Well, I'd have very little to add to that. I think that analysis is correct. People are always looking for people. States are looking for counters on the board that they can use. I mean, it's a form of power. And they KSA is a very terrible actor, really, for prosecuting this war against Yemen, the greatest humanitarian disaster since World War II. And we seemingly must do everything to help Saudi Arabia because of their arms purchases and because of their support of the dollar.
Let me ask you, Greg, we'll go back right to you, and then we have about a little less than 5 minutes. One of the stories that you suggested for this week's segment was the political importance of Russia's announced new nuclear capabilities. They need to be assessed. They're in different stages of development and deployment. I was just reading an article, I think it's today, it's in the Politico magazine. It's called Putin's Phony Arms Race. Russia announced, quote, new, close quote, systems aimed at defeating U.S. defenses. They changed nothing. And the author is Admiral William Perry, who actually knows a lot about nuclear weapon systems. He was Secretary of Defense, I believe, in the Clinton administration. But his point is that the new doomsday weapon that Putin announced that got a lot of press sort of misses the point. The media coverage missed the point, which is the Russians and the Americans already have sufficient weapons delivery systems that they can defeat any missile defense shield, and that the idea that the U.S., which did leave the ABM treaty in 2002 and provoked a new arms race, the idea that they now have the technology to stop retaliatory attack, which would be, you know, necessary for mutually assured destruction, that that's all nonsense anyway. Anyway, let's talk about this.
Well, he's right. And what we've got is this same magical thinking, a different form of it, that somehow U.S. technological superiority allows us to be able to dictate terms to the world. The people who authored Trump's nuclear posture review were active in the late Cold War with the trying to spread the idea that victory was possible, that we could conduct a nuclear strike against Russia and have only 20 million dead on our side. And these are very crazy people, and most people in government thought that. So the output of the negotiations in the government was a kind of compromise, but still a nasty compromise. And Perry has to write an op-ed and say, just wait a minute, we have never stopped being vulnerable. And I don't know, you know, why that has to be said, but we don't have a functioning ABM system.
The U.S. leaves the ABM treaty in 2002. And by the way, just for our listeners, that's also when the Nuclear Posture Review, I think at that time under George W. Bush, announced that North Korea would be eligible target for first strike nuclear attacks from the United States. And that's when North Korea left the NPT and began building nuclear weapons. But Kevin Kamp said, that's the reality. Even if the U.S. leaves the ABM and starts building missile defense shields, there is actually no defense. Do you see it that way?
Well, I heard Defense Secretary Perry speak late last year at a nuclear weapons symposium at the National Cathedral. And one thing that he said that really struck me was that he went to bed every night during the Cuban Missile Crisis as a close advisor to the Kennedy administration, thinking it was his last night on Earth. And I'm reminded of our previous conversations about the individuals during the Cuban Missile Crisis on a Soviet sub who voted against launch of a nuclear-tipped torpedo that would have sparked all-out nuclear war between the U.S. and Soviet Union, and a later example in the 1980s where individuals made a difference. And then we mentioned the movements like the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, who are thousands of people across the world, hundreds of organizations that rightfully so got the Nobel Peace Prize. That's where the hope is people taking action for abolition in response to the madness. And some of those people have high government positions. Some people are sitting at the on switch for firing nuclear weapons. And we've just, as a species, we've got to solve this problem before it catches up to us.
All right, I think we're going to leave it there. I want to really encourage our audience to find out more about the Los Alamos Study Group. Greg Mello, your website?
LASG.org.
LASG.org. And beyondnuclear.org is the website for Kevin Kemp's. We do have to build a grassroots movement. It has to be strong. It has to be broad. Everybody has an interest in it. And I hope people use this segment, which comes to us every Wednesday with Greg and Kevin. On Twitter, we're at Loud Clear Radio. Our Facebook page is Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. Go to those websites. Let's spread the word about the dangers, the perils posed by the nuclear industry and nuclear weapons, and let's do something about it. That's really the most important thing. This information, we hope, will stimulate action. Anyway, we've been joined from Albuquerque, New Mexico by Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, and we're joined in the Washington, D.C. area by Kevin Kemp's, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.